Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. It's March 30th. I'm going to move around on the agenda. I'm going to open a public hearing on 916 first, and I think Senator Johnson's here. But then I have to go, as soon as I have a quorum, go to work sessions. So then we'll jump out of 916 and go to work sessions, and then we'll get back on track. So I'm moving around a little bit, but we will be able to hear everyone. Also, I want you to know we have a timer here. It's 3 minutes a person, unless you're a legislator. Unfortunately, they take a whole lot of time. and also sometimes the proponents, two or three key proponents of a bill, and opponents of the bill, I give a little bit more time. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 916 and Senator Johnson and Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 916 requires the Oregon Medical Board and Oregon State Board of Nursing to adopt rules regarding diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease. It requires the rules to permit professions to treat Lyme disease consistent with standards of care guidelines developed by the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, Lyme disease and associated viral and bacterial and parasitic diseases. No fiscal and revenue statements have been issued yet, and there is no amendment.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your courtesy. My own committee is meeting right now, and I'll need to leave. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. And frankly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill was not on my radar screen until my constituent, Trooper Brody, reached out to me. And we had such a compelling conversation on the telephone that I agreed that I wanted to come down and offer my support not only to her, but also to this bill. And so I can't say it better than she can. With that, I would conclude my testimony and ask my constituent, Jesse Brody, to share with you her experience.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I'm going to excuse
Bye.
Myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sit down. Thank you for the honor of speaking here today. My name is Jessica Spurlock Brody. I live in Clatskanie, Oregon. I'm here because I support without modification Senate Bill 916. In 2005, I moved to Oregon to take my dream job as an Oregon State Trooper. I have worked my entire career in Astoria, first in the Fish and Wildlife Division, but later finding I loved working patrol. I was thrilled to become a technical collision investigator in 2013, primarily investigating critical injury and fatal collisions. But now I am on leave without pay status with the Oregon State Police, and I'm facing medical retirement if I cannot return to work in the next 4 months. In early 2012, I began having symptoms of what I now know to be classic signs of Lyme disease, a very stiff neck and chronic migraines, light sensitivity, tingling of my arms, legs, and face, ringing in my ears with temporary hearing loss, extreme fatigue, joint pain, and much more. My primary care physician mentioned Lyme disease to me, but when I could not remember any recent tick bites or bullseye rashes, she dismissed it and offered to prescribe me pain medication. In 2014, I switched to another primary care provider because my symptoms had progressed, so that I was told I either had Lyme disease, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, or ALS. I was very scared and I needed answers. I underwent many tests. In March of 2014, I tested positive for Lyme on a Western blot IgM. I began treatment immediately. Several months later, an infectious disease doctor in Portland told me I either never had Lyme and several co-infections that I also tested positive for, or that a few months of antibiotics had cured it. But I still had most of my symptoms. He told me the positive test results were unreliable in his opinion and that I should discontinue antibiotics. I've been treated for 1 year by a doctor in Washington State under the ILADS guidelines. I am much improved. Unfortunately, I still have a long way to go due to the 2-year delay in my diagnosis. My parents are moving out of the house I purchased with them because it's in foreclosure due to my loss of income and medical bills. I've been diagnosed with a sleep disorder, fibromyalgia, hypothyroidism, visual ocular deficiencies, and bilateral cubital tunnel syndrome. Prior to 2012, I was very active and healthy with no major health issues. Lyme disease has profoundly affected my ability to have an active life, to be a good mother to my 6-year-old son, a good wife to my husband, and to meet my financial obligations. Lyme disease has affected all aspects of my life. Senate Bill 916 is key to making sure that people can get a timely diagnosis and local treatment options, two things that were not possible for me. I humbly ask you to fully support this bill. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it. Teresa Denham, Steve Heppy, and Kate McLaughlin.
Good afternoon. Thank you for senators for introducing Senate Bill 916. We encourage you to move this bill forward to vote without amendment. The International Lyme and Associated Disease Society is the first organization to issue guidelines on Lyme disease using the IOM grade process, a process recognized by the World Health Organization and others. It is difficult to understand why Oregon medical boards and Oregon nursing boards have not yet adopted these guidelines that have been here for 10 years. Currently, Oregon only uses a guideline developed by individuals with conflicts of interest. We need to adopt all published standards of care available, making options with positive patient outcome our primary focus to patients and their Oregon MDs without fear of disciplinary action. I don't believe ignoring the consequences of using a narrow and restrictive guideline is an effective strategy. Undiagnosed Lyme disease is budget busting, and the direct and indirect costs of Medicare, Medicaid, and to families is crippling. At 28, I began having neuropathies, and I was told I had MS. By 41, I was very limited in function. That year, I was finally diagnosed with Lyme disease by an out-of-state physician. It took me 2 years to regain my health, and today I am healthy. This opened my eyes, and I started the Oregon Lyme Disease Network. Patients in Oregon are sick for an average of 9.2 years and see an average of 6.5 specialty doctors prior to their diagnosis of Lyme disease. 83% of the patients with clinical symptoms and CDC-positive tests reported that they were misdiagnosed by their doctors and nurses in Oregon. Misdiagnosed patients often undergo expensive, unnecessary tests for symptoms that are caused by Lyme disease, such as MRI, CTs, cardiac catheterizations, endocardiograms. 80% of our patients report being ostracized by their physicians, especially infectious disease doctors and neurologists, and in some cases, even their PCPs. Families are not only fighting for medical needs, but they are being harassed by a community that we trusted. A path, disability, and pain of Lyme disease is worse than that of cancer, and has a longer duration, yet no support is offered to the patients. Additionally, many begin self-medicating because they're not getting the help, using illicit drugs, and that creates additional problems for the state of Oregon. Patients are getting ignored because the guidelines are restrictive, diagnosis is missed, and physicians are afraid to diagnose. No Lyme, no treatment here. One CDC proficient laboratory reported 166 positive CDC cases in 2014. However, our state only reported 31 to the CDC, and only 12 became confirmed cases. That means only 7% of the CDC patients actually were diagnosed in Oregon, and probably, therefore, only 7% were treated. Prior to diagnosis of Lyme disease, patients often have neurological, cardiac, skeletal, and depression issues, which are followed generally as chronic disease. In Oregon, chronic disease accounts for $1.4 million in hospitalization cost alone. A national study on the impact of this cost to the government, the employers, and the nation's economy said Oregon's total cost of disability is $16.5 billion. One needs to ask how many of these costs were associated with misdiagnosed Lyme disease and were actually treatable illness. In fact, 70% of our 105 surveyed patients progressed to chronic Lyme disease, resulting in disability prior to their Lyme disease diagnosis. Let me be clear, we're talking about patients diagnosed with a life sentence of multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, autism, arthritis, and cardiac issues. Patients who have incurred thousands of dollars trying to improve their health. These patients, when properly and effectively diagnosed, were treated at a fraction of the cost of their lifetime diagnosis. It's clear the narrow and restrictive current guidelines in Oregon are not working, and it's costing the state hundreds of thousands of dollars. But this isn't only about cost. Behind me, you will hear a lot of suffering today. Science is emerging, but if it's not getting recognized in Oregon by our medical board and nursing board, we will continue to see these gross losses. We need to turn this around, and I urge you to adopt SB 916 without amendment.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll do the panel and then open it for questions.
My name is Katie McLaughlin. I'm a physical therapist in Eugene, Oregon. I worked at a chronic pain center for 11 years, so I know this from both sides, as a patient and as a treater. In 2007, I started getting profoundly fatigued, and I was tested for mono and many other things, and was treated, but to no avail. In 2009, I had such extreme joint pain that I couldn't walk down my stairs in the morning. In 2011, I had to quit my job because I was having to hold myself up on the walls. I couldn't even stand, much less treat or lift patients. By 2012, I was on crutches, paying for my own MRIs, testing and treatment out of pocket. In 2013, a naturopath in Seattle tested me for Lyme, unbeknownst to me, and it came back CDC positive. I walked out of her office because I told her I didn't want to have Lyme. It's not exactly a choice. But I finally consented to treatment, and after a month, I was able to walk without crutches, and my brain fog was lifting. I had enough energy to return to work full-time as a PT. I wasn't totally well, but I had part of my life back. I moved back to Eugene in 2014 to start my own PT practice. I was told by a fellow Lyme patient that I couldn't get treated for Lyme here in Oregon. I'd never heard of the medical profession being limited in this way, and honestly, I didn't believe her. But after seeing multiple practitioners, I found out what she said was true. They would verbally discuss Lyme with me, but they weren't even willing to write it into my chart, even though I could come with the paperwork showing a CDC positive test. I'm now getting treatment for my residual Lyme, and I'm back to working 50 to 60 hour weeks. No one should go without proper treatment that is available in the United States, and that's why I'm working with the Oregon Lyme Disease Network to get this bill passed. To restrict medical professionals from appropriately treating and diagnosing Lyme is something I've honestly never heard of in my 40-some years. The current IDSA testing protocol is only 19% to 56% sensitive for Borrelia, which is the bacteria that causes Lyme. So there's a massive false negative testing rate. Even among the patients who do get tested, many who actually have the disease are being told they don't have it and so are not getting appropriate treatment. When they do get other more sensitive testing, they're found to be positive, but the struggle to get treatment here in this state continues. We need to allow doctors and nurse practitioners to treat as they're trained, with all the evidence-based tools available to them. The current narrow set of diagnostic tests with a large false positive result causes undue harm to patients. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Hi. Let's see. I guess this is working. My name is Steve Heppe. My wife is in the audience, Mary Jane. We both urge you to support this bill as is, without any amendments that could erode its protection of medical professions, of medical professionals in our state. Lyme disease is an insidious illness, and our medical professionals need flexibility within the full range of established medical guidelines in order to diagnose and treat this disease according to their best medical judgment. Our family has experienced this disease firsthand. Mary Jane started showing symptoms back in 1998, but she never saw a tick bite and never got a rash. Blood tests for Lyme disease remained negative for several years. We've since learned that these blood tests have a high false negative rate, as you've just heard. Mary Jane went through multiple doctors and multiple false diagnoses, including fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis, and mental illness while her symptoms worsened. She also had two medical procedures based on doctors' recommendations, which in hindsight were unnecessary, before finally being correctly diagnosed in 2005. By that point, 7 years after the onset of symptoms, she was severely disabled. From personal experience, we know that Lyme disease is difficult to diagnose and can be extremely debilitating. Mary Jane has now essentially recovered, but it has taken literally years of very aggressive and expensive therapy. Tellingly, no medical doctor in Oregon has helped with this recovery. We have not found a single MD in Oregon who is willing to diagnose and treat this illness and its co-infections with the long-term therapy that was needed. Instead, at great expense, we rely on doctors in California. In our Lyme disease support group in Hood River, which has a population of about 7,500 people, we have 24 formal members. We're also aware of roughly 100 people in the area with Lyme disease. That's roughly 1% of the total population. Their stories are similar. Years of misdiagnoses as symptoms worsen. A complete inability to find a practicing MD in Oregon that will diagnose and treat this illness with the long-term therapy that is needed. These folks either rely on naturopaths, who have greater freedom to practice according to their medical judgment compared to our state's MDs, or they attempt to self-treat. Ladies and gentlemen, our house pets and our horses can get Lyme disease here in Oregon and receive effective treatment, yet the human population cannot. This is a sad testament to the politicized nature of this disease. As you know from other testimony, there are currently two standards of care for Lyme disease. One standard of care, promulgated by the Infectious Disease Society of America, suggests that Lyme disease is hard to catch and easy to treat. This is the only standard of care currently recognized in Oregon. The second standard of care, promulgated by the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, recognizes that Lyme disease is easily misdiagnosed, that the disease can progress to a chronic condition if not treated early, and that long-term therapy may be needed in the case of chronic illness. In selected forward-looking states across the United States, doctors can practice according to this standard of care without fear of improper reprisal. Yet, if an MD in Oregon attempts to treat according to this standard, he or she literally risks their professional livelihood due to improper disciplinary action exercised by their governing board. Doctors need the flexibility to practice according to either standard of care in accordance with their best clinical judgment. Please help. This legislation will enhance options for patients who are seeking diagnosis and treatment for Lyme disease in Oregon. The bill that I am asking you to sign, Senate Bill 916, will allow practitioners to act in the best interest of the patient within scientifically recognized standards of care without fear of punishment from the disciplinary system. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Really quickly, I just want to clarify something you just said, because I've really heard two very different things. I've heard that doctors don't agree with the guidelines, but then I heard you say also that doctors won't use those guidelines for fear that they will be punished by their medical board. Could you clarify those two things for me, please?
Yes, I think a really great example is today we had four physicians who were for sure going to be here, and they are MDs, and they currently treat using the standard within the state, and when they reach the point where they cannot treat any longer, they refer their patients to California. All four of them backed out this morning. Two of them mentioned that just this last week they were notified by the board that they should not be considering testifying. So there is a lot of pressure from some outside source. We don't know the exact mechanism for these doctors to not even take Lyme patients at all. We've seen it all over the state. I've got 1,500 patients who have called me over the years since I have been doing this, and it's only getting worse.
May I have a couple of quick follow-ups?
Uh-huh.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So I'm a practicing physician, so
yes.
This is a little different from anything I've heard. I have not heard of the medical board telling physicians that they can't testify on something before. This is the first time I've ever heard anything like that. I'm not disagreeing with you or doubting
right. The
people, mm-hmm. but I am saying that from my perspective, it would be helpful if you would ask those physicians to get in touch with the Oregon Medical Association or with
they
me
are
as,
afraid
a sen-
to.
As a senator mm-hmm. Directly. If you could have them email
contact
me.
You
they
directly.
Can email me. Yes, that would be great. They could email me as a senator. That would be very helpful. I'd like to know about that and get a little bit more clarity about how they heard that. But the other thing I want to clarify, if I could, when you say that they've reached the limits, do you mean that they've reached the limits and insurance won't pay for it anymore, or they reached the limits and they've been told by this? Because I don't have a sense as a physician that I've ever been told you can't prescribe antibiotics for longer, for example, than are recommended for this particular disease. If I want to prescribe antibiotics for strep throat for 14 days, which is way beyond the standard, I can do that if I want. It's not a good idea, but I can do it. So I'm really puzzled. I'm not doubting you. Please be clear. I just want to understand this a little bit better.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I will see what we can do. We've asked the doctors to speak. They are very afraid. They are afraid of board sanctions.
Okay. If you would have them get in touch with me directly, I would really appreciate that. And I would like to be able to talk with the Oregon Medical Association about this as well to see if they're hearing anything from their members. I believe they may be testifying on this as well, and if so, I'll ask them directly. But it's outside of my experience to have the board go proactively and say to someone, you can't practice this way when there hasn't been a complaint, mm-hmm. or you can't testify, because that's a restriction of free speech, and we don't like that.
Right. And I do think that we did give you we gave you one physician statement for sure, because I submitted that. The other physician statements, like I said, they backed out and felt that they did not want to lose their licenses. They're very afraid.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I would like to make a request from the nursing board and the medical board regarding standards of care for Lyme disease. And according to you, there really isn't one.
Let me clarify that, Madam Senator. There are two standards of care, actually, for Lyme disease. So there is one standard of care that actually is recognized here in Oregon. It's the standard of care promulgated by the Infectious Disease Society of America, the IDSA. This standard of care does not recognize the existence of chronic illness and states that a limited course of antibiotics of 30 days is sufficient to cure an illness if treated early. But the interesting thing about the guidelines, if you read them, is that there is no statement of what to do if it's not treated early. So it's an interesting logical flaw in the standard. If you treat it early, I think most people will agree that 30 days of treatment will suffice. If you don't treat it early, the question is, does the disease progress to a chronic condition? The IDSA would say no. ILADS would say, yes, it can. The ILADS standard of care is not recognized here in Oregon, and our experience, our own personal experience, as well as all the patients that we've talked with over the years, is that no medical doctor in Oregon will at least publicly treat outside of the IDSA guidelines. And in fact, you should question, as people testify today, this was an interesting theme that I think you should follow up. You should ask each person testifying, are they being treated by a medical doctor or a naturopath? And if they're being treated by a medical doctor, where is that medical doctor located? I think you'll find that in virtually every case I'm aware of, that medical doctor is not in Oregon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I also wanted to, not to get scientifically geeky, but part of the problem with testing for Lyme, it's a spirochete, the bacteria. And so the IDSA tests that they rely on are all serological in the blood. And that isn't where most of the spirochetes are. And so depending partially on the timing of the testing, that's why 19% is ridiculously low, but that's tested too early. Or if it's tested later and the spirochetes aren't in the blood, then you won't find the disease, even if you have it, because it's not in the blood.
So it's timing. You have it. The doctor may screen for it, but it won't show up. So that means probably in a month or two they should be testing again. Is that
if they tested too early? Yes, that's correct. But most of us are tested way late. Like he was saying, it was 5 years down the line before Mary Jane got a Lyme test. I got tested probably 7 to 8 years down the line. So it isn't often too early. There are some that are too early, but most often it's too late.
No, I relate to that because a very good friend of mine has Lyme disease, and it was a little over 10 years before they finally figured out what
right.
it was. And by
right.
then it was really too late to do much good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to keep it open, but I need to go into some work sessions right now. So I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 7.
Senate Bill 7 directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to procure or supervise the procurement of Oregon Health Authority's information technology. There's a dash 2 amendment and no revenue impact and a minimum expenditure impact.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 7.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 7. Colleagues, do you need an explanation of this from anybody, or are you all comfortable with the amendment? I know that Diane Lancaster is here if you need it. Doesn't look like it. So is there any other discussion, any opposition? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 7 as amended by the dash 2 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 7 with the dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner-Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman Sanders?
Aye. Motion carries. It's Senator Courtney's bill. He will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 7 and open a work session on Senate Bill 224.
Senate Bill 224 exempts the Oregon Health Authority and Department of Human Services from provisions related to real property that is sold, acquired, mineral or geothermal resource rights, or the proceeds from the rights that are held or acquired. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact.
And colleagues, we have Randy Blackburn and Rick Mills to explain why we need to send this to Judiciary. Do you need that information? Okay.
I'll be there.
Yes, you will. Okay.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Senator Cruz moves to Senate Bill 224 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to Judiciary. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator
Kilt? Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Mulsanne?
Aye. Motion carries. And I should have said this at the beginning. Senate Bill 608 is in the process of having another amendment, and so that is off the schedule for today and will be scheduled for Monday, April 6th. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 415.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 415 prohibits the sale, distribution, or allowance of sale of flavored tobacco products or flavored inhalant delivery system products. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to impose civil penalties for each violation. There is a dash one amendment that removes the prohibitions on inhalant delivery systems and flavored inhalant delivery systems. There is a minimal fiscal impact and revenue statements have been issued.
And Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 415.
Senator Cruz moves that the dash one amendments be moved into Senate Bill 415. And colleagues, this basically takes out the vape industry, the e-cigarette industry from flavoring, will allow them to do flavoring, and then takes the tobacco. And I know that Jim Gardner and a number of people came and let us know the financial revenue impact that this will have by taking those off, out of circulation, so to speak. So we are going to be sending it to revenue. We're sending this bill 415 to revenue because it does have a substantial revenue impact.
I don't think it's as substantial as they say. But
well,
okay.
If you look at the figures that we got, do you have the revenue in front of you? There was a number of emails, particularly from a number of people. Let me get the right bill out here.
Because LRO is saying no revenue impact.
That's right. But I have been asked by people to send it to revenue. The general fund could face a loss of over $31 million annually or $62 million for the biennium. The Oregon Health Plan would lose nearly $26 million in the 2015-17 biennium. And, of course, this came from the opponents of the bill. But I feel that revenue can deal with this matter much better than we can. Okay. Any other discussion?
I already moved the amendment.
Okay. Any opposition to the amendment?
No, the amendment I'm fine with.
Yeah.
That amendment I'm fine with.
Okay. All right.
The amendment's adopted.
So the amendment's adopted. All right. Now, okay. There is no opposition to the amendment. All right. Now, we will, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 415 as amended by the dash one, dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Finance and Revenue Committee.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 415 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Finance and Revenue Committee. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Madam Chair, if indeed the potential revenue impact is real or not real, I think it's important that the Revenue Committee dig into that. So I think this is an appropriate place to send it, and they can make that determination.
Yeah, I was confused, too, the fact that I was, for those that opposed this amendment or this bill coming with huge numbers for revenue, and yet revenue tells us that it's not, I felt that was enough information to send it to revenue.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Even if the revenue projections are true. I still would strongly support the passage of this bill because I think we have to put our kids' long-term health and the long-term economic well-being of the state ahead of current revenues. And I know that even if it's a big fiscal hit, we can figure it out, or we can delay implementation so that we can plan it for the 17-19 biennium. But I refuse to support the ongoing sale of tobacco products, which puts our kids' lives at danger and puts the long-term economic well-being of the state in danger on the back of revenue right now. That is just penny-wise and pound-foolish, Madam Chair, and I refuse to let the revenue piece be a reason to not pass this bill.
And I would agree with you. I mean, we do know tobacco products have carcinogens in them, and they cause cancer. So there's no question about that, but we do have a process, and we are going to send it down. Any other? So we've moved the amendment, correct?
Yeah. Okay, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Zach Knope?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
No.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senate Bill 415 is going to revenue. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 415 and open a work session on Senate Bill 416.
Senate Bill 416 requires smoke shops to pay fee to the Oregon Health Authority. There's no amendment, and the stolen revenue impact statements have been issued.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 416 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to Finance and Revenue by prior reference.
What? Finance and Revenue? 416. 416 doesn't have to go to Finance and Revenue.
416? I'm reading my list.
I don't remember that ever being told that was going to Finance and Revenue, but nobody told me that.
Okay, we're just going to close the work session on Senate Bill 416 and move it on to Wednesday until we have this clarified, because I did not see that it was going to revenue.
Does it need to go to revenue?
Let me stand at ease for a minute.
Okay, let's stand at ease, please, Derek.
Back on.
Oh, yes, we're going to reconvene, and then we're going to carry over Senate Bill 416 to Wednesday, April Fool's Day. All right. So I'm out of work session, and I'm going to reconvene. I forgot about 8:33. I'm going to open a work session So I'm going to reconvene 9:16, and I would like to call up Dr. Ann Thomas, Courtney Dresser, and Sarah Basler.
I'm just reading the script, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, sometimes all of us we can have our colleagues, but better to know for sure.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the Senate Committee on Healthcare, I'm Ann Thomas, public health physician with the Acute and Communicable Disease Program in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. I am board certified in pediatrics and preventive medicine, and I'm here today to provide information on Senate Bill 916, which is related to the treatment of Lyme disease. Lyme disease is caused by a bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi, that are transmitted to humans through the bite of an infected tick. Prevention for the disease includes the use of insect repellent in areas where ticks are common, removing ticks promptly, and reducing tick habitat. Lyme disease is relatively rare in Oregon. While there are 36,307 cases of Lyme disease in the United States in 2013, there were only 43 cases in Oregon. This translates to an incidence for Lyme disease of 8.6 per 100,000 nationally, compared to 1.1 per 100,000 in Oregon. Lyme disease is diagnosed based on physical symptoms, including headaches, fever, fatigue, and a skin rash shaped like a bullseye, in addition to exposure to Lyme disease-carrying ticks. Nonspecific symptoms like fatigue and joint pain are common, and Lyme disease is one of hundreds of diseases that can cause these symptoms. Diagnostic tests exist for Lyme disease, which test for antibodies made by white blood cells that are responding to the infection. However, it can take several weeks after infection for there to be enough antibodies to be detected, causing some patients in the early weeks of the disease to test negative. According to the CDC, it is not until 4 to 6 weeks post-infection that the test is likely to be positive. This does not mean that the test is bad, only that it needs to be used correctly. Once diagnosed, Lyme disease can be successfully treated by use of antibiotics. If left untreated, the infection can spread to joints, the heart, and nervous system. Patients treated with antibiotics in the early stages of the infection usually recover rapidly and completely. Most patients who are treated in later stages of the disease also respond well to antibiotics, although some may have suffered long-term damage to the nervous system or joints. Approximately 10 to 20% of patients experience fatigue, muscle aches, sleep disturbance, or difficulty thinking even after completing a recommended course of antibiotic treatment. These symptoms cannot be cured by longer courses of antibiotics, but the symptoms generally improve on their own over time. Senate Bill 916.
Please, if you want to make comments, you need to go out into the hallway. Thank you.
Senate Bill 916 would require Oregon Medical Board and State Board of Nursing to adopt rules regarding diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease that are consistent with guidelines developed by the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. These guidelines are not endorsed by the CDC and conflict with the evidence-based, scientifically supported guidelines developed by the Infectious Diseases Society of America. The IDSA guidelines currently represent the best available synthesis of the medical literature on the diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease. The IDSA, with input from CDC experts and other doctors, has developed and published Lyme disease treatment guidelines. In addition to the possibility of promoting improper treatment of Lyme disease, the guidelines established by Senate Bill 916 could result in additional and inaccurate reports of Lyme disease that would require follow-up by state and local public health officials. In conclusion, the guidelines that would be established by 916 do not represent the best evidence-based treatment options available to treat Lyme disease. Validation of these guidelines as the accepted course of treatment can result in the use of unnecessary and potentially harmful therapies. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
I have received information from more than 43 Oregonians, and you said in your testimony that there are only 43 Oregonians. So how does the data come? Are they reported by the physicians who have cases? How do you know that there are 43 cases of Lyme disease in the state of Oregon?
Just diagnosed that year, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Chairman Anderson and members of the committee. That was 1 year. I had no doubt there are more in the state. But it's typically, it's because it's a notifiable disease, laboratories are required to report. So it's fairly sensitive if someone has had a positive laboratory test.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And let's hear from the panel and then ask questions.
Good afternoon. Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. We are here to oppose Senate Bill 916 as it is. We are sympathetic to the stories of folks behind us and appreciate them being here. However, placing diagnosis and treatment protocols into the Oregon Medical Board is not the great use of the Oregon Medical Board. How standards or protocols are achieved through community standards is how we do things in the practice of medicine and how we should continue doing those things. I think especially around this issue is that there's not agreement within the physician community on what standards we should or shouldn't be using. So putting these in is just not an appropriate use of the board. And just to answer probably a follow-up question, have we heard from any members on this issue? At this point, we have not, but I have asked our staff up at OMA North to let us know what's happening.
And this is the association, not the medical board.
Correct.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Sarah Basler on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. Also here in opposition to Senate Bill 916. For some of the reasons you've already heard, and our primary concern is that this legislation treats one condition very differently than how it treats other conditions within the board structure, putting the standards of care in rule isn't something that's typically done at this level. The role of the board is to protect the public by regulating the practice of nursing. There is also language in the bill allowing professionals regulated by the board to diagnose and treat, and I would note that diagnosis is outside of the scope of practice of many of the professionals regulated by the Board of Nursing. And we had some concerns around the language regarding the disciplinary procedure as well. The board does have the authority to discipline licensees for violations of the Nurse Practice Act as well. So thank you for your consideration.
Having known people with Lyme disease and how it has been misdiagnosed and how some do go out of state, how do you foresee then we address the problem that we have in the state of Oregon of proper treatment of care for our Lyme disease? I am moved by the stories, and from what I hear, the standards of care don't happen here in the state of Oregon. And so I would like to know then, okay, if you're opposed to the bill, how can we get there so that these people can be properly treated in the state of Oregon?
Well, this is Courtney with the Oregon Medical Association. I think there is a standard of care. I think that they disagree with that standard of care. So I think that's just the... I don't know if the different advocacy groups are all on the same page yet.
Okay, well, and it's just hard when you hear testimony of finally they find that, is it the ILADS treatment of care works for them. I mean, it works for them, whereas nothing else had before. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dresser, Ms. Basler, Dr. Thomas, do you have any sense that, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, the medical board and the nursing board have never set a standard of care for a specific, they have guidelines around, we have accepted use, community standards of care for a whole range of things, and that's one of the things we look at when we're concerned that a provider is practicing outside of standard acceptable guidelines. But have you heard about providers being disciplined by either of your respective boards or in the infectious disease community, Dr. Thomas, public health community, for using a different standard? If a physician agreed more, an MD physician or a nurse practitioner agreed more with the ILADS guidelines than with the IOM guidelines, the CDC guidelines, is it plausible that he or she would be disciplined for that? I'm really surprised by this whole piece because it just hasn't been in my experience. I'm not saying it couldn't happen. I'm just wondering if you've heard that in your experience.
We have the medical board that representative that could come and speak for the medical board.
But I'm just wondering about, I'd love to have them speak, but I would be interested in your perspectives as well, what you've heard from your members.
From the Oregon Medical Association, we have not heard of that.
And Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'm not familiar with that happening at the Board of Nursing, but that would be a question they'd be able to answer with more clarity.
Okay, thank you. But yeah, if we could, Madam Chair, if there aren't any other questions,
yes.
I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern is that we've heard from multiple people, at least I have, and I think we heard some today, that they're getting different kinds of treatments in other states, in California, on the East Coast. And so I guess my question is why is there a disparity? Why such a disparity? And why are those states treating it differently than Oregon does?
Chairman Monis Anderson, Senator Knopp, I think we don't know why. I mean, it's not like we've surveyed clinicians to know. I think certainly on the East Coast where the disease is more common, I could understand that perhaps there might be different standards of care. I can't explain why there would be difference between West Coast states.
Well, that's why we have the bill.
Make a quick comment about that? You know, my experience having done medical school on the East Coast and come west to do residency is that standards of care vary a lot. And it's not just about based on guidelines like this, but I think you can argue about what are the parameters for when you do hip replacement surgery or when do you order an echocardiogram. Yes, there are guidelines for those things, but I would bet you dollars to, I know for a fact, I don't even have to make the bet, I know for a fact, because if you look at things like the Dartmouth Atlas, which looks at Medicare expenditures and when certain things are ordered, if you look at people who've trained in different residency programs in the same specialty in different parts of the country, the understanding of the best ways to treat certain things vary, and which guidelines people follow vary depending on where they practice. So communities set up their own standards of care, and historically, Oregon has set up its own standards that are not necessarily the same of even our neighboring states, California and Washington. Sometimes that ultimately turns out to be a really good thing, and sometimes it ultimately turns out to be not such a good thing. Where we are in this case, I don't know the answer to that, but just because we have a standard of care in this state, if someone chooses to follow a different guideline, as long as it's not way outside the pale, I personally have never heard of someone being disciplined for that, as long as it's something that a reasonable physician in this state would think an appropriate kind of care. I haven't heard of physicians being disciplined under those circumstances. If it's way outside the pale, you know, if they're doing something inappropriate, sure, that's one thing. But if they're following a national society's guidelines, even if it's not the Institute of Medicine or the CDC, which are sort of standard national ones, I haven't heard of people being done with that.
Okay, thank you very much, panel.
All right, because it's taking longer, we're going to have to limit the people to 3 minutes. What will happen, you'll have 30, Scott Gallant, you'll have 30 seconds when the yellow light comes on.
I wouldn't suggest giving Scott more than 30 seconds.
The yellow has already appeared, Scott.
And
Madam
Chair.
And by that I summarize.
My apologies, but Madam Chair, but after Mr. Gallant, I'm going to have to leave for another producer's schedule meeting.
Scott Gallant representing the Oregon Medical Board. For the record, I am not aware of the Medical Board disciplining physicians, nor any conspiracy in regard to this particular standard of practice, as has been implied by some testimony. I don't think we know whether there's a different usage or standard of practice in this area between here and California and Washington, because we don't have that data, actually, and there's been no comparator to do that. Third, the standard of care is typically done by national specialty societies, rigorous review, CDC, and others, to draw a consensus. There have been instances in this state where the medical associations, specialty societies, and interested parties have developed a consensus on guidelines where there are conflicting differences of professional opinion on what approach to take. Because sometimes in medicine, as you know, it's not necessarily black and white on what is the appropriate approach. Differential diagnoses can be exceedingly difficult and complex, which has historically been true. Other than that, willing to work with the committee. However, I think the language of the bill, this is highly unusual to have the board adopt a standard where there are multiple standards. First of all, adopt a standard at all. That is not their role. But to choose one over another is highly unusual, would set a horrible precedent, in my view. There are hundreds of other illnesses and diseases where there may be disagreement, and you will see them in the future requesting the same thing. And I think that will cause quite a stir, at least with the medical community, and I don't believe the Board of Medical Examiners is truly set up for that role. And as a policymaker or policymakers, I'm not sure you want them to.
Thank you. Can I just have one other comment about that? You know, the legislature has long been sensible about, for example, not putting language in statute about certain things that could be changed by an outside organization. So if, for example, ultimately, so if we put in a specific society's guidelines into statute and that society no longer exists, but the evidence evolves, for example, that could leave the state and doctors in a really tough place, Madam Chair, which is the other reason I have some concern about specifying it, leaving aside any question about what's the best way to treat it. From a simply statutory process perspective, the legislature has long been very careful about not referencing specific agencies or groups that are not necessarily guaranteed. Referencing the CDC, for example, on something is reasonable since the likelihood of the CDC disappearing is small. Representing something, you know, referencing something else might be more challenging in the long term as a statutory precedent.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. The next panel is Chris and Kara, is it Chaika? Chaika and Mike Dewey. And Beth Schwartz. And please tell your story, but you don't really need to repeat. Just you can say my situation is similar to the other. But yeah. You can go ahead, the person in the middle, and while right. She gets set up.
Dear Honorable Senate Health Committee, my name is Beth Schwartz. I have Lyme disease that has been verified by 9 CDC positive tests from 4 different laboratories. My first test was December 10th, 2004, when I presented with optic neuritis. The first positive test was not shared with me. The doctor then ran a second test, which was still not shared with me. I returned back to the doctor with my second case of optic neuritis and was tested for my third time, which again was positive, but I was told that it was inaccurate and I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Shortly after that, the Oregon Health Department called me to ask me where I obtained Lyme disease. I said, "Do I really have Lyme disease?" My doctor said no. They then called my doctor and asked him to treat me. I was treated with 30 days of antibiotics. I did feel better for a bit, but it did not go away. I asked my doctor for more antibiotics, and I was told I would have to get a new doctor if I talked about Lyme disease again. So I did go get a new doctor. That neurologist sent me off for my fourth test. Again, it was positive. They asked me to see an infectious disease doctor at OHSU. I went to Portland. My appointment was canceled for a power outage. When I tried to reschedule my appointment, I was told that it was not necessary to see me because I did not have Lyme disease. I asked how I didn't have Lyme disease with 4 positive tests and requested a phone call. He then called me, and he told me that I had LymeDisease.com. Get off the internet, and it will go away. I spent many months researching, and I found a neurologist in Connecticut. He was a teacher at Harvard, and he understood Lyme and multiple sclerosis. Before I went out there, I saw one more local doctor asking for a spinal tap for Lyme disease. I wanted every possible test I could have before I went there. That doctor denied my request, and he diagnosed me with strong denial syndrome, an obsession regarding alternative diagnosis. What I really had was 4 CDC positive Lyme disease tests. I was a struggling single mom at the time with no other choice but to fly 3,000 miles for medical care. The doctor there tested me again, and again I was CDC positive for Lyme disease. He prescribed me 90 days of IV antibiotics. My new neurologist in Oregon had said he would treat me with an out-of-state doctor's recommendations. When I got back to his office, he was upset the doctor had faxed him and not called him and said that he could not listen to his recommendations because it was disrespectful the way he acknowledged him. It took me over a year to get that IV antibiotic and PICC line from another doctor. After the IV antibiotics, I had a follow-up MRI, and almost all of my brain lesions had disappeared, 13 of them. I then moved on, I got married, and I had a baby. After my daughter was born, I had a terrible relapse. I lost all feeling in the left side of my body and all of my legs, and I walked with a cane. I asked to be treated for Lyme disease, and I was told no. I got on a plane and went back to Connecticut, and once again I was diagnosed with Lyme disease and co-infections. I was given a 3-year oral antibiotic treatment from him. I am now in remission, and I work very hard to maintain my health with diet and healthy lifestyle. Life is still different for me. I take no extra special care of myself. When I feel stressed or do not sleep, I start to lose my eyesight and the feeling in my body. I will never just be a normal, healthy person again because too much damage was done.
I am writing that I'm here today because I don't want to see anybody else go through the pain that I did.
Thank you so very much. Thank you so much.
My name is Mike Dewey. I was bitten by a tick in Western Douglas County on June 6, 2013, while in performance of my duties as a forester for the Oregon Department of Forestry. I was diagnosed with Lyme disease by a medical doctor in Roseburg and treated in accordance with Oregon IDSA guidelines, receiving the maximum recommended dosage of 28 days of antibiotics. When I became sicker, my MD told me that even though I had two CDC-positive Western blot blood tests for Lyme disease, he couldn't treat me further because the treatment that would be required to cure me would be in excess of Oregon IDSA guidelines, and that if he prescribed that, he could get in trouble with his licensing board. Another medical doctor told me similar. I became sicker, so sick that among other debilitations, I couldn't speak in complete sentences until I finally found a naturopathic doctor that treated me in accordance with antibiotic dosage guidelines of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society. It took 8 weeks of intravenous antibiotics and 8 months of oral antibiotics at a cost to me of almost $10,000, but I am now cured. Had my medical doctor not been intimidated by his licensing board, he could have treated me much earlier in my illness with much less antibiotics at a much lower cost to me, likely $200 to $300. In the course of my illness and treatment, I met many other Lyme disease-infected Oregonians that were experiencing similar or worse health impairments than those that I experienced. Every single one of them had been treated and not been cured by antibiotic dosing in accordance with Oregon IDSA guidelines. The resultant worse illness that is the consequence of that failure to cure imposed profoundly negative impacts to their lives, to their families, and to the communities that they live in. As such, I respectfully submit to you that preventing these worse illnesses should be of paramount concern to you. I was astonished at the inability of the medical community to respond in an appropriate manner to prevent my illness from becoming worse, and it was preventable medically, as evidenced by my subsequent cure with antibiotic treatment in accordance with the ILADS guidelines, but it wasn't preventable politically. Lastly, I offer to you that while this is a physician protection bill, more fundamentally, it is a human rights bill. However, unlike other human rights legislation that have served to protect the rights of individual demographic groups, this legislation serves to protect the rights of all humans, the right of all Oregon humans to have a life-crippling bacteria removed from their bodies. Currently in Oregon, dogs have this right more than do humans. Knowing that Oregonians deserve this right, and that, as with every other human rights legislation, history will show that there was no rational basis to oppose it. Please do the right thing. Pass this legislation.
Thank you so much. Powerful stories.
Hello, my name is Chris Chitka, and this is my wife, Kara, and we are here in support of Senate Bill 916. In 2001, at the age of 23, my wife's fine motor skills started to deteriorate. Her speech started to slur, and she had extreme joint pain and difficulty walking. She saw her primary care physicians, and they did not consider the possibility of Lyme disease, even though she had recently spent 3 weeks in New York. We were referred to neurologists, and after months of testing, the doctor at the MDA clinic diagnosed her with ALS. His parting words of wisdom were to go home, make your wife comfortable, get her wheelchair, and if she's afraid to hold her children, don't let her. Kara, being a stubborn Italian, did not accept his advice and instead started doing her own research on ALS. And in doing so, she found others who were also diagnosed with ALS who were later diagnosed with Lyme disease. Kara contacted one of these people that lived in Texas and himself was an MD. He gave her the name and contact information of the doctor who diagnosed him. We later contacted that doctor and asked if there was an MD close to us in Oregon, and he was not aware of one that was Lyme literate. So we traveled to San Francisco to see that doctor and started treatment for her Lyme and co-infections. We worked with a new primary care physician in Oregon in concert with the California doctor, and Kara got treatment for 1 year. After that 1 year, the primary care physician here was told by infectious disease doctors and neurologists that it was impossible for her to have Lyme disease. With increasing pressure from those doctors, our primary care stopped treatment, even though Kara was showing signs of improvement. After her treatment stopped, Kara began to go downhill fast. As she continued to get worse, she required 24-hour care. In 2008, I had to quit my job and as apprentice pipe fitter to care for her. Luckily, the state has a program that allows me to care for her and our three children. Since her treatment stopped, I lost my job, gained 100 pounds, and we lost all of our friends. The kids have had years of counseling and missed out on their mom being there for many life events. We strongly believe that if we would have gotten early treatment, since with the year of treatment she had received, she showed signs of improvement, she might have had a different outcome, and we would have been able to be a contributing member of society. We would still have our friends, and our three children would have a healthy and able-bodied mother in their lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And did you have insurance that would... I'm trying to figure out, is this an insurance problem, too, that insurance won't cover it after a certain amount? Okay, all right. Thank you so much. Yes.
It sounds like we heard from both Mike and Beth that you had antibiotic treatment for an extended period of time. Maybe, Mike, it sounded like maybe yours was almost a year. Beth, yeah. I think you said...
100 days of IV and then 3 years of oral.
And yet... Oregon's standard of care is 28 days. Is that
right?
Yeah.
So I guess my question is why are other states having a different standard of care and we're at 28 days? I mean, is this a, you know, an issue of, you know, fear of antibiotics becoming rendered useless? But I mean, it seems like if the other states are doing a different standard of care, that Oregon needs to look at possibly upgrading ours. So, did both of you go out of state to get care?
I went to Connecticut and California.
I found care through a naturopathic doctor here in Oregon. But with respect to your question, I think it's possible, probable even, that because in Oregon, Borrelia burgdorferi is an emerging pathogen, that the medical community has just not become informed about this new pathogen in our midst. And until that happens, we'll be stuck with an inadequate treatment guideline. And this bill is about increasing the rate of knowledge acquisition for physicians with a direct benefit to the patients.
So just follow up. So Mike, in your case, it sounded like you've been, I don't know, completely cured. Is that the right
I don't know if that exists with Lyme disease, frankly.
Okay.
I've been asymptomatic for a year and a half.
Okay.
And but if I may, I didn't want to run over 3 minutes, so I left some things out. But I got the first dosage of that 28-day dosage on day 20 after the tick bite. And it still didn't cure me. So that's exhibit A for that dosage having very little efficacy in nearly any Lyme infection situation. I'd only presented symptoms for 5 days before I got treatment, the maximum allowed in this state, and it didn't work.
And just follow up, and did you have a test, a confirmed test,
yeah,
during that time frame?
No, it was too early for the blood test to be positive, so my doctor advised me to wait, and it came back positive. He diagnosed me based on symptoms.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And thank you, Chris, and your wife's name is
Kara.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Sharon Lee, Marty Denham. Patricia, Jesse, Brody. And remember, 3 minutes, okay. Go.
My name is Sharon Lee, and somewhere, what do I have to do to get it up on the screen? Okay, thank you. My name is Sharon Lee, and I'm an RN, and I have three things that I have compiled into a 9-page testimony that is written for you. This is just one portion of that. So I have actually been a victim of Lyme disease for 37 years. It was not diagnosed until year 24. In the last 13 years, I've had extensive antibiotics, and last year I had a culture, and my culture was still positive. I'm also the co-leader of a 206-person support group in Southern Oregon, in the Medford, Jackson, and Josephine counties. What I wanted to talk to you today about is information about those few things, and then to talk about the Oregon Department of Health and how confirmation of Lyme disease occurs in this state. Physician and laboratory reporting requirements are physicians and other clinicians are required to report Lyme disease cases within one working day of diagnosis to the Oregon Department of Health in their county. Labs are required to report positive test results to the Oregon Public Health in the patient's county of residence. County public health officials follow up on cases to confirm. And each county's confirmed cases are then reported to the Oregon Department of Health, who in turn report them to the CDC. The first thing that is reportable is an erythema migrans rash. It's often described as a bullseye rash. However, very atypical forms of this rash are seen far more commonly than the bullseye. No other disease has this EM rash, however. Fewer than 50% of Lyme disease cases actually develop that EM rash. And basic information about Lyme disease, this is from the ILADS, was retrieved online. And they also report across the nation that less than 50%. CDC confirmed cases are a case of EM rash with a known exposure, a case of EM rash with laboratory evidence of infection and without a known exposure, or a case with at least one late musculoskeletal, nervous, or cardiovascular system manifestation with laboratory evidence. The Oregon Department of Health says that the physician has to document an EM rash and the patient must have positive laboratory evidence of infection, just those two things. So laboratory evidence includes a culture and a two-tiered Lyme test. The first one is the ELISA, and if that is negative, then the person does not have Lyme disease. If it's positive, it has to be confirmed by the second tier, which is a Western blot. If that is positive per CDC standards, which means that two starred bands of the IgM or five starred bands of the IgG have to be positive to be confirmed. The EM rash and two-tiered Lyme test was recently brought up in a researchers from the CDC and New York Medical College reported that actually 60 to 71% of Lyme patients that actually had the EM rash tested negative. So we've got a couple of ways that our patients in this state are falling through the cracks and not being counted. The Oregon Department of Health guidelines for investigators, of which I was an investigator at one time, said the case definition for Lyme disease is restrictive and intended to enhance the specificity of surveillance.
Is this online?
It's in your packet.
Yeah. So it is on OLIS, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank
you.
You're welcome.
So much.
Mm-hmm.
Honorable members of this committee, we ask you to vote for 916 without amendments. Our daughter was bit by a tick.
Your name again is?
I'm sorry. I'm Martin Denham. Our daughter was bit by a tick while camping when she was just a toddler. We asked the pediatrician if the red rash around the bite was Lyme disease, and she told us no way, not in Oregon. Over the next 2 to 3 weeks, our daughter developed classical Lyme symptoms, including the rashes. Over the next few months, she developed the swollen knee, rashes, fevers of unknown origin requiring recurrent trips to the doctor, and 2 hospitalizations. There were dozens of nights of fevers requiring medical attention. By age 12, Ashley had multiple invasive and expensive tests, 13 specialist doctors, 18 different medications, including cardiac and seizure drugs. She continued to fail. When we asked these doctors about Lyme, they said basically, no way in Oregon, and some ridiculed us. At age 12, Ashley saw a doctor who was new to Oregon. He diagnosed her with Lyme disease based on the clinical symptoms and the two-tiered gold standard test, and he began her treatment. He was subsequently reprimanded by the medical director at the clinic and ordered to stop treating her. So he referred us to an infectious disease specialist, Dr. Bryant, at OHSU. Dr. Bryant called us on the phone, not having examined her, and told us that she had a false positive test despite her symptoms. He instructed us to discontinue the antibiotic treatment.
And this was where? OHSU?
OHSU, ma'am. Undaunted, we took Ashley to the East Coast, where she was examined, tested, and found to have Lyme disease along with babesia and ehrlichiosis. Her Lyme doctor was shocked that her absolute classical presentation was ignored by doctors and specialists. She improved on the ILAD standard of care. These doctors worked with Ashley's PCPs here in Oregon, who would do supportive care. And over the next several years, we and our daughter went through a cyclical routine of Oregon support doctors discontinuing her ILADS treatment and telling us that the residual symptoms were not Lyme, consistent with what the nurse representative said earlier. Over the next several years, however, the symptoms recurred, and the positive blood tests, and I want to emphasize this, including two positive PCR, that is the DNA of the bacteria tests, indicated she was still infected. When we asked the East Coast and California Lyme specialists why she was so difficult to treat, they said she went for 9 years without any treatment. Ashley stabilized to an almost normal life by age 20, but she missed having anything resembling, a normal childhood and teen years. At this time, she is happily married and she has 3 healthy children. Our family was terribly impacted. Our, quote, vacations were often spent traveling to out-of-state doctors. We have spent, we estimate, $185,000 out of pocket, and that includes almost $75,000 for IV ceftriaxone. We tried the IDSA protocol, and it failed her badly. But through the ILADS treatment, our daughter got better. Our daughter had bacterial infections that should have been treated with antibiotics and science, not adversity and harassment. We urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you so much. And now you're the second one that said you called infectious disease at OHSU. And I would like to have the name of the doctor that you spoke to or whoever, because we would like, usually in situations like this, we then have OHSU is so responsive in following up on particular cases. But that would mean we would need to have your name and your physician. So I think there was another. If you could do that.
We have the paperwork at home, and I'd be happy to submit it.
That's right. You just submit it to our, and then we'll follow up. Thank you so much.
Matt.
Yes.
You need a release, too.
Yes, and a release of information. Yeah. Okay, Deb Elder, Dylan King, and John Bruce. Go ahead.
I want to play a really quick recording for you.
Correct. And so I guess I don't understand. I have infections, and you're telling me that on Lyme disease there's no...
Our doctors don't treat for Lyme disease here. That's just their choice. They don't have...
Good day, Senators. I'm Dive Girl Deb, a.k.a. Deb Elder. Our doctors don't treat for Lyme disease here. That's our choice. I appreciate you hearing my recorded call to Peace Health you just heard a snippet of. I hope it helped you to realize the urgent nature of this dire situation. Our Oregon MD and MPs are afraid of board sanctions and have adopted this position. Patients are truly in an emergency medical, emotional, and financial situation. I have been experiencing symptoms of Lyme disease since 1984. In 91, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. I've been fed over 63 pharmaceuticals by 39 doctors to mask my symptoms. I was assigned to a chronic pain center where I was given outrageous amounts of pills, 22 oxycodone a day for 5 years, followed by 12 years of methadone. I couldn't take the array of effects any longer. I attempted to commit suicide in 2004. My father had to call 911 to revive and rescue me. I currently have degeneration in my lumbar disc, residual damage from the untreated Lyme infection. I was given a spinal fusion to stabilize me, which cost over $100,000. In December 2012, I crashed. My body couldn't hold up any longer. I spent the next 16 months bedbound. I paid out of pocket for my Igenix laboratory testing, which finally gave me a diagnosis of Lyme disease and Babesia, a co-infection of Lyme disease. I have Babesia WA1 Duchenne, the West Coast version. With 17 species of Babesia, patients are frequently given false negative results. I can't prove my infection strains under the current narrow Oregon medical criteria. All of my infection medical care to date has been paid out of pocket at $500 a month from my disability funds. Babesia is a parasite of the red blood cell. Much like malaria, Babesia is life-threatening. My untreated Babesia is the cause of Lyme carditis. This infection caused my cardiac events, which sent me to the hospital 6 times in 2013. And as of today, my infection has not been treated. Please listen to my recorded call again when you get back to your office. Peace Health is the infectious disease group for all of Lane County. I visited with Dr. Ormosher mid-2013. She and her 8-minute appointment told me there was nothing she could do to help me and sent me away. I tried again with a new ID doctor referral, and that's the call you've heard. Oregon has squirreled away tens of thousands of sick patients, most under symptomology names like fibromyalgia, MS, chronic fatigue, Alzheimer's, depression, and others. Oregon simply can't afford a failure to treat policy. We do have Lyme in Oregon. It's harming our citizens and our state. Please pass this bill as it's written.
Thank you so much.
My name is Dylan King. I was diagnosed with Lyme disease in 2011. I come from Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, an area highly endemic for Lyme disease. The past 4 years have been an unimaginable nightmare. Before I was diagnosed with Lyme, I was a very active father of two and heavily involved in residential drywall. I worked 50 to 70 hours every week and also had a janitorial business on the side. I was the hardest worker most of my friends knew. Previous to 2011, I felt relatively healthy. Unbeknownst to me, I apparently had an incubating or non-symptomatic Lyme infection in the background that was causing fatigue and some extra shakiness, nervousness that I had just shrugged off. I had been bit by ticks tons of times because of my active lifestyle and also had a family pet that would bring them inside. My dog Reuben was diagnosed with Lyme, went blind from it, and subsequently died. So I was healthy until 2011 when I had a routine surgery. After having that corrected, I went back to work, and after about a month off my feet, I went back to work as normal, doing drywall. 6 months later, I couldn't walk more than 10 feet without a wheelchair and couldn't do stairs at all. The pain in my legs and the whole lower half of my body was that bad. I was having severe migraines, severe pain in both legs, and terrible pain in my groin and abdomen. I went from doctor to doctor and hundreds of physical therapy appointments trying to get a handle on things. My family doctor vowed to get to the bottom of it, and after running a bunch of tests and doing research, she diagnosed me clinically with Lyme disease. This is in Lehigh Valley Hospital back in Pennsylvania. I tested positive for rickettsia, which is another tick-borne infection, and CDC negative for Lyme disease, but had Lyme-specific bands on the western blot that would have probably shown me positive before Lyme was politicized in the early 90s. After I started getting treated, things got much, much worse. I now needed a wheelchair in the house and spent most of my days in the bathtub or in bed. Since then, it's been ups and downs of severe pain, fatigue, decreased quality of life. I'm now divorced and after 11 years of marriage and still seeing no light at the end of the tunnel. I'm a 32-year-old father of two.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. My name is John Bruce. I'm a resident.
Bring the microphone closer to you.
Thank you, committee, for hearing us today. I appreciate you listening to us. Once again, my name is John Bruce. I'm a resident of Medford, Oregon. a merit. I have a wife, Lisa, who's a CPA down there and a former president of the Southern Oregon CPA Association. I have two children. I'm a graduate of Willamette University. I'm a former assistant baseball coach at Willamette University. I have a master's degree in exercise science from the University of Arizona, and I'm a former assistant baseball coach at the University of Arizona. I'm here today to support this bill, SB 916, without any amendments. I have Lyme disease, and many of the tick-borne co-infections that you've heard about accompany it as well, probably another five or six other diseases in themselves. Bartonella, Anaplasma, Ehrlichia, Podomyxoa. I have been diagnosed by an MD in California on this, and I've been treated by him in his clinic in California originally from the get-go on these. He asked me, why are you coming down here? I said, because I can't get help. And no wonder, he says, I have thousands of people coming down from the Northwest. This is in the Bay Area in Redwood City. All of these pathogens have been both serologically and clinically diagnosed. As I said, these diseases, headlined by LD, have critically devastated my health and my livelihood, not to mention the impact on my wife and my family. I've coached college and high school baseball for over 38 years. This chosen profession has found me on the baseball field outside for countless springs and summers in over a dozen states and half a dozen countries. 2008, while coaching the New York Summer Collegiate League, that I was infected. However, I will tell you that I was bitten numerous times by ticks just growing up in rural southern Oregon, right? Ticks all the time over animals and that kind of thing. And I did, when I was a teenager, have an early rash, as you saw illustrated before. In 2008, while coaching New York Summer League, knowing that New York was the ground zero for Lyme disease, I asked our team doctor what the odds are of being infected. He thought they might be about in the 15 to 20% range. He's an MD. I knew that percentage was way too high, and so I got started on amoxicillin and the normal protocol then at that time for 10 days. Little did I know at that time that the antibiotics for that short a period of time was not enough, and if anything, probably made future treatments more difficult, the adjustment, of course, and the morphine by the pathogens themselves and the resistance to the antibiotics. Over the next 12 to 18 months, for the first months, the first of the chronic symptoms began to set in: extreme fatigue, headaches, brain fog. You've heard them all today, everything, 30 to 40 different systems. Sleep disturbances, twitching, never-ending headaches, tremors, optic neuritis, neuropathy, seizures, memory loss, cognitive problems, on and on and on. The latest addition diagnosed just last year by an MD in Medford is called hyperacusis. Severe sensitivity to sound. My ENT doc in Medford referred me to a specialist who was at OHSU at the time. She and the hearing clinic, have thus, since the last year or two, moved off of the campus of OHSU.
We need to move on. I want to thank you for your testimony. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I just
I'm going to tell you her name, and you wanted names, Dr. Marcia Johnson. She sees Lyme patients all the time. Hyperacusis induced by Lyme patients in Portland. Dr. Marcia Johnson. Okay.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Madam Chair, another thing about Mr. Bruce there, he was my little brother in the Fidel house across the street. So we've known each other for a very long time.
I want to thank you so much. We have to move on, and so whatever testimony you please, you can share it with our community administrator. But we have now Elizabeth, is it Irode? Irode, and Jessica Brody, and Patricia. And we have two other bills besides this, and we're supposed to be out of here in 15 minutes. So there, it only says Patricia. So if you're, so we better come up, because this is the last it. Please proceed.
Okay. Before I begin my prepared remarks, I'd like to just make two comments, if I might, to answer a question that you posed, Senator Knopp. And that is, if we're only permitting a 28-day treatment, why are other states or why are other places providing longer than that? And what I would like to do is refer the committee to a very well-known study. It's called the EMBERS trial, the EMBERS monkey trial, that is the most current study that we have right now that speaks to the persistence of the Borrelia bacteria, And the Borrelia bacteria is not eradicated in 28 days. And the reason why they did that trial was obviously to prove that there is ongoing persistence of the bacteria. The second comment I'd like to make is to, I don't know who the representative was from the medical board, but she said that that ILADS did not have an evidence-based guidelines or standards. That's patently false. In fact, ILADS in 2014 not only created an evidence-based standard, but they upgraded their standards from 2004. The ILADS standard of treatment is now the most current standard of treatment for Lyme disease, far more current even than what is promulgated by ITSA and the CDC. The other thing I'm going to do is a little bit of speak off speech, and the reason is you've heard a lot of testimony, and I don't want to be redundant. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 916. My name is Elizabeth Arrow. I'm a member of the Oregon Lyme Disease Network, and I applaud their years of hard work, and I thank you, the Committee on Healthcare, for sponsoring it. I've been a resident of Oregon for 17 years. I live in Wilsonville along the Willamette River, and my home and that of my surrounding neighbors is a haven for deer and diverse species of migrating wildlife. Most people associate Lyme with a tick and a deer. What I want to tell you is that there's a life cycle to the ecosystem, and there are lots of other creatures besides deer that carry the Lyme, and migrating birds carry them from other states to different locations. Summarizing my real-life tragedy into 3 minutes of sound bites is impossible, because I have spent the past 7 years confronted with unimaginable, frightening, destructive, debilitating, and incapacitating suffering. From 2008 to 2012, I went 4 years misdiagnosed, and in 2013, 5 years untreated. My life, at least the one I had planned for, worked for, and enjoyed, and hoped to continue into old age, has been decimated by Lyme disease and a co-infection that you've heard about earlier, Babesia duncani Y1. These insidious pathogens have stripped me of my once vital health, a 16-year marriage, and the company I created with my husband, one of the fastest-growing private companies in Oregon, the contractor that was chosen to renovate this state capitol, the contractor that was built the first propriety center for Facebook in Prineville, and also worked on numerous jobs in Oregon. We've employed hundreds of employees and made millions of dollars of economic impact in Oregon, but I could not get treated in Oregon.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. These are really impactful stories, Patricia.
Okay, my name is Patricia Waters, and I urge you to support SB 916 with that amendment. I am the legal guardian for my granddaughter, Summer Garza, who with proper testing through IGNX Laboratories was diagnosed with Lyme disease in 2008 when she was 14 years old. By the time Summer received a positive diagnosis for Lyme and began the proper treatment as prescribed by the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society, the following had taken place. In 1997, Summer was bitten by a brown recluse spider, and in 2000, she was bitten by a black-legged tick. Both insects are Lyme carriers. Summer was living in Oregon at the time. Summer's symptoms began in 2003 after her family moved to Oregon, when at age 11, she began to have headaches. By age 13, the headaches became ongoing and severe. Over the next year, she began to have ongoing muscle aches and pains, tingling sensations in both hands and forearms, numbness at times, pain in her body increased. Next came vertigo and dizziness with accompanying upset stomach. At times, her speech was garbled, and she would have difficulty stringing words together. By age 14, in addition to the symptoms above, her headache worsened. She described it, quote, like a steel ball expanding in my head, about to explode. Several shooting pains started, and they would come at random times. Then came periods of fainting. All symptoms worsened, and by now she was having hallucinations on occasions, was severely depressed, and had a feeling of going crazy. During this time, Summer's primary care physician, who had been caring for her since age 11, was baffled by all her symptoms. Meanwhile, I was on the internet trying to learn what could be the cause. I knew these symptoms were not psychosomatic. When I suggested to Summer's doctor that I believed she had Lyme disease, He studied the now very long list of symptoms and compared them to Lyme symptoms, and he gave a clinical diagnosis of Lyme. Following Infectious Disease Society Associate guidelines, he ordered the Western blot test, which came back negative, as is usual a case when a patient has had Lyme disease over a period of time, because the immune system is no longer fighting the illness. And this is an important point about the Western blot. In spite of the negative result on the Western blot, Summer's primary care physician was convinced she had Lyme and gave us a referral to a neurologist, and I'll give the names. He's at OHSU, Dr. Koch, K-O-C-H, who refused to recognize the possibility of Lyme because the Western blot came back negative, and instead referred her to biweekly pain coping clinic. When her symptoms became increasingly worse, she was referred to physical therapist, a rheumatologist. And I do have a list. I put down OHSU by the names I'll give them to you because I was hesitant to do that before. So she was then referred to a physical therapist, rheumatologist, an infectious disease specialist who stated that there was no Lyme in Oregon and that the Western blot test was negative, and referred her to an anesthesiologist for pain control, who again referred her to a rheumatologist. In January 2008, Summer ended up in the psych ward at Emmanuel Hospital she was attempted suicide. The psychiatrist also denied Lyme disease because the Western blot test had proved negative.
Ms. Waters?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I just sum up that Summer?
Oh, we have the written testimony, and it will be put into the record.
Because the important part is one more sentence.
Okay, one more sentence.
Well, we did take her out of state to Washington to a doctor who treated her by the ILADS standards. She was on antibiotics for a year and a half. At age 23, she's now graduating from PSU, and she is Lyme-free. She would not have been if we had not taken her out of state. She got no help in Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. That's who we have. What I think I'm going to do, as you know, this is very unique. We don't really put standards of, no, put it, give it to Derek, standards of care in statute. So it's extremely important. I think I'm going to send a message out to our health policy and research group, Dr. Janine Smith, we need to take a look at the standards of care in Washington and in California in particular, but also on the East Coast. And if our standard of care is so much less than the other states, we need to do something about that. But our process is such that I am hesitant to put something like this into statute. I think we have to get the community on board. So, Rosa, are you taking notes? Rosa Klein from OHA, and I'm not sure if you can get the message to Dr. Janine Smith on the health policy and research. Yeah,
Madam Chair, I think that is a good approach. I think if nothing out of this testimony, it's definitely elevated our awareness as
Absolutely.
A body. And I think while we have difficulty putting standards of care by statute into the medical profession, we do have leverage, particularly when it comes to the Medicaid population. And while we might not be able to tell doctors generally what to do, I think we can ask the coordinated care organizations to report to us on how they're handling these kinds of things. And maybe we could have the Oregon Health Authority come back to us with a memo at some point during the session to update us on what they've been able to find.
I think that's really critical, because I think maybe what it comes down to is cost. I mean, when you need to be on antibiotics for a year or so, doctors are saying, no, they don't want to do that. I'm not sure. Send me emails. We can keep the record open until, what's that?
916.
Yeah, we're going to keep the record open so that you send us so we can get it into the record. It's really important for OHA to get the information, especially all of your testimony, which has been very impactful. And I can't take raised hands here. We have to move on to the next bill. But I thank you so very much for coming. You definitely have made a difference. And just realize that we probably can't pass the bill as is, which I know so many of you wanted, but we are going to be doing work on this. Thank you so much.
Thank
All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 916, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 833. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 833 requires the Oregon Health Authority to give coordinated care organizations at least 30 days advance notice of any amendments proposed to existing contracts. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Bill Murray and Bill Guest. No, I'm and please, you must stand back. You can't do that here. We have decorum. Sorry about that. And I'm a Willamette grad too.
Yeah, right. But you weren't a Phi Delta.
No, I wasn't. Please proceed. My dad was, though.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Murray. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Family Care in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 833, which would add a 30-day notice requirement for any contract renewal or amendment to our CCO contract. The purpose and benefit of this amendment is to provide sufficient advance notice for implementation changes that impact CCOs and the delivery of care to the over 1 million people that are now served in Oregon by CCOs. Whenever there is a change, adequate time is necessary to ensure continuity and coordination of care with minimal disruption. Time is necessary for us to communicate and educate our staff, providers, the members we serve, and to inform the communities that we operate in. It's unfortunate that there's a history of the existing targeted goals of providing us that information timely of not being met. Most recently, Family Care and other CCOs received their 2015 contract on December 24th, a nice Christmas present. The requirement to review and sign that we were given was less than 7 days. Those need to be back in to the department by December 31st. You'll see in front of you, I handed out over there, a copy of the letter that we sent on December 31st outlining those issues. Page one in the bracketed text talks about the receipt date of our contract and the requirement that we submit it no later than December 31st. The second page also outlines the issue that nobody was available to address our concerns during that period, and we had significant concerns about contract language and our rates. We were informed once again that it was a requirement that we sign the contract if we wanted to continue to provide care and service to the members we serve in our community, which in the Portland area now total more than 120,000. In summary, I would support moving this bill forward, support the 30-day requirement. Personally, I would also look for additional provisions in the bill to make that stronger to ensure that we have adequate time to be able to prepare and provide the coverage that's so necessary and so important to the people we serve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, it's Anderson, Senator Cruz, Senator Shields, glad to be with you today. My name is Bill Guest. I'm the Executive Director and CEO of Willamette Valley Community Health CCO in Salem. We have 100,000 enrollees, and I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 833. CCOs are complicated health care entities. We coordinate care for tens of thousands of people. Our budget for 2015 will be for over $400 million, 100,000 folks in Marion and Polk counties, nearly one out of four citizens here. These contracts require legal review, financial review, risk management review, governance approval prior to partnering with those we work with. Our partners consist of, in these two counties here, 600 physicians, physician organizations, 12 hospitals, 100 pharmacies, counties, durable medical equipment companies, home health care agencies, lots of folks. And many of these entities have their own internal management boards that need to approve on contracts. And under recent health care reform, health care plans have been asked to move away from the more simpler traditional fee-for-service contracts, which were easy and had evergreen laws, into much more complicated contracts that have risk-sharing arrangements and asking our partners to align their incentives. They have to assess risk as we put in things such as withholds and risk sharing. And changes in the contracts with from the state then result in a domino effect of contracts having to be signed downstream. And we need at least a minimum amount of time in order to be able to put through a contract. And we had a similar situation on December 24th. We received our final contract and sent a letter to the state saying our board meets once a month. Can we meet January 20th instead? And can we have a delay? And we were told, no, your payments would be cut off. And so our only choice was to sign a contract without being able to get the normal approvals we would get and then ask for retro approval. It's just not a good way to do business. And you know, we want this because we want to ensure that our enrollees have good networks, that we have sufficient providers to meet whatever the state has in the contract, and good business sense and good for our enrollees would be to have a 30-day notice, and that's what we're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Does OHA want to report on this bill? There's no opposition. So we're going for it. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 833 and open a work session on Senate Bill 833.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 833 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 833 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Clerk will call the roll.
Second.
Excused.
Sam Shields.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. It's Senator Bates's bill, and so he'll carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 833 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 757. Zena.
Senate Bill 757 appropriates funds for the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and the Oregon Center for Nursing for data collection analysis to encourage healthcare providers to practice with underserved populations or rural areas. Fiscal and revenue statements haven't been issued, and there's no amendment.
All right, let's start with Doug Barber, Patricia O'Sullivan, and Byron Boehringer.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, go.
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Brian Boehringer with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm here with a coalition of healthcare partners that support Senate Bill 757, the Senate bill that you've been looking for all day. Senate Bill 757 would allocate funding to the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and the Oregon Center for Nursing to work together to collect the data and perform an analysis of the performance and effectiveness of programs designed to encourage providers to practice in underserved and rural areas. Maintaining an adequate supply of healthcare providers in rural areas has been challenging in Oregon. Over the years, the legislature has created and funded several programs in an attempt to recruit and retain more providers to rural and underserved areas. As you well know, these programs are under constant pressure to maintain funding because of limited amounts of revenue available. Last interim, the Oregon Health Policy Board Workforce Committee looked at a range of healthcare provider incentive programs in the state. The committee was asked to recommend how to monitor the program's effectiveness and to suggest strategies for sustaining, expanding, and/or retargeting the programs as necessary. One of the committee's recommendations was that the state needs better data collection and analysis. We believe that Senate Bill 757 should be used to collect that data. Our hope is that we can use the data to drill down into the specific needs of the community. For example, the Rural Health Tax Credit currently uses distance to population centers and the size of the population center to define eligibility. We would hope that with better data, we could look at the communities and look at the need and assign providers as necessary. The OMA encourages you to pass Senate Bill 757 and send it down to Ways and Means. I'm happy to answer any questions after the panel concludes. We also have Joe Iskrig and Jana Bitten from from OE as well as the Oregon Center for Nursing if you have technical questions.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I think Mr. Boehringer said everything I wanted to say. We've been very supportive of these incentive programs in the past, but it is time to find out if they're working. You just keep adding them and adding them, and we don't really know if they're working, and we should be doing something else. So we ask that you pass this bill, send it to Ways and Means with a due pass and fund.
Yes. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians and the Oregon Rural Health Association in support of Senate Bill 757. As we've talked about before with this committee, the interim work groups looked at all of these incentive programs. There was no shortage of ideas about how we might modify those programs, but we lacked the information that we really needed to fully understand how those modifications would impact the number of providers, the distribution of providers. We really do need this data, and we encourage you to support Senate Bill 757. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
And just a comment, Madam Chair. I had an interesting conversation with Representative Buehler just yesterday on this very subject. I think this is very appropriate and very timely that we do this.
Thank you. All right, Jack Dempsey, Scott Ekblad.
Chair Bonus Anderson, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey representing the Oregon Nurses Association. You have my written comments in front of you, so I'll just summarize and say that we support Senate Bill 757. And to be honest, the reason is pretty simple from our standpoint. I mean, I have talked with every member of this committee at some point over the last 4 or 6 years about some aspect of these programs. And the questions are, what happens if we move this to urban underserved? What happens if we put an income cap on this? I never have an answer for you guys, and won't. And I think this will at least get us to a point where you can have good analysis in front of you to decide, you know, next session or whenever, what you want to do with these, how you want to target them, if you want to restrict them, expand them, and this will give you that data. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health. Our office administers either entirely or in part most of these programs. So not only do I agree with everything that's been said up to this point, I want to give you just a bit of perspective. Over the years, as these programs either come up for continuation funding or the sunset comes up for the tax credit, the ideas about how to change the programs start flowing. And I just want to list some of the ideas I've heard over the years. Restrict them to only Frontier Oregon, tier the incentives according to degree of rurality, expand the programs to include urban, restrict the incentives to only those below a certain income threshold, disallow practitioners to benefit from more than one incentive program, change geographic eligibility criteria to reflect a different opinion of what is rural, restrict incentives to only primary care, restrict incentives to only those specialties critical to important rural communities, restrict incentives to those specialties for which we have a documented shortage, expand incentive programs to include oral and mental, expand incentive programs to include pharmacists, occupational therapists, and naturopaths, impose a limit on the time a practitioner can receive an incentive, restrict incentives to those who keep their practices open to Medicare and Medicaid, restrict incentives to only those who practice full-time, restrict incentives to only those who practice in a federally designated health professional shortage area, restrict incentives to only those who practice in an area of unmet health care need, restrict incentives to those only those who are newly recruited to an area of need. Those are just the ones I could remember off the top of my head. So, to be perfectly honest,
you mentioned mine.
Okay. To be perfectly honest, I don't know if those are all bad ideas. I don't know if they're all good ideas. I don't know which ones are better ideas than the other. The only way we're going to know is if we take seriously not only data collection but comprehensive analysis and evaluation of these programs. I believe that if Senate Bill 757 were to pass, we could come back to the Legislative Assembly in 2 years with a relatively quick gap analysis that could give you some guidance, and in 4 years we could come back with a much more comprehensive set of recommendations as to what to do. So thank you for this opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great.
Madam Chair, just a comment, because we've been involved in a lot of these over the years, and what we've done has been brilliant. It'd be also nice to know if it actually is working.
Do we have technical questions for the two ladies that have been here throughout the whole?
No, this is very needed, and the technical questions will be answered once the bill is passed, won't
okay.
they?
Okay. Well, what I'd like to do then is carry over this bill, Derek, to April Fool's Day, April 1st. And if there's no other further comments, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 757. And I just want to make sure that we are leaving the record open for Lyme disease 916 for 24 hours. Let's say 24 hours. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.
What are we doing for 24 hours?
Leaving lines. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.
What are we doing for 24 hours?